Well, welcome everyone. My name is Kate Evenson. I'm a pastor at Mercy Seat Lutheran Church. It's a church in northeast Minneapolis. It's a mission start. And I spend a lot of my time with that. And then I also do adjunct preaching, teaching at Luther Seminary with Caroline Lewis and David Lowe's. And teach all first year, second year, seniors, and even some of the THD students. So I'm preaching, so it's a lot of fun. Do all sorts of weird writing stuff. But anyway, I'm glad you're here. Thank you for making it out on this Friday. And we're going to begin as I kind of like to begin mornings because I feel like we fill so much of our white space of our life with voice and noises. So we're going to start with some silence, just 3 minutes of silence. And I had a Benedictine, I studied with Benedictines for 6 years, and one of our instructors there, she was Meg, oh gosh, why am I blanking on her name? Anyway, Meg, she used to tell us that people feel that they have to have focused thoughts when and while they pray, but she actually encouraged to let your thoughts wander, because that's where maybe your prayers need to go. And so just let your thoughts wander, pay attention to those thoughts, and then be attentive to them throughout the day. Okay, we begin in the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Gracious God, the stone that served as the tomb door has been rolled away. Some claim it is angels. Others are sure it is nothing, a small transgression. Yet the whole world, in solidarity with this heavenly tale, offers acknowledgement of its certainty. Even the earth must now point to this new truth. Things small and green begin to push aside the soil. Light is now stronger than darkness. Death is no longer the final word. The world that has gone underground can now make promises. Now, because of this one, this terrifying, simple event, there is no shelter, no sanctuary, nothing that can protect us from your desire. For this great gift, we offer our gratitude, praying as always, into your holy name. Amen. Amen. For those of you who came in just now and didn't have grab a Bible, please do so, and welcome to all of you. And we're just going to work right with the Bible. I like the Bible sometimes. Today is one of those texts. How many clergy people or theologically trained people do we have in this room? Good, good. So you probably are familiar with this text and some of its complications. And every Easter, when it's the year of Mark, and we have to preach on this as the resurrection text at Easter, it's always a little bit of a stumper because, as you'll see, and when we get into Mark 8, there is no Jesus appearance. There is no resurrection. And we can look at the other Gospels and note that there is a resurrection scene, which makes it easy to talk about Jesus on Easter, but in Mark, it just ends. But before we get into the text itself, I want to get some of your thoughts on what is resurrection? Or where do we find it? Because we too have not seen Christ, not in the flesh. Where do you find resurrection?
I hope for it in the future.
We were just talking about that yesterday, sort of. Tuesday. Am I writing too small?
Yeah.
You know, since I keyboard everything, I can't write anymore. It's like my handwriting has just gone to pot. So hope for it.
It is too small too.
I'm sorry.
I run around really big now.
You want big holes, not little.
Okay, it's possible for you now.
Is that enthusiastic enough for you, Brian?
That is mushy spit.
Huh?
Brian says.
What, I keep hearing.
Oh, we're just sassing.
I couldn't read it, so she made it bigger.
Okay, I thought she had said something about resurrection.
I see resurrection and being able to tease people, actually.
Earth?
Earth.
Oh, okay.
You should put the cap back on, she said. We get the, I don't know if they're taping this, but they get the best side of me here. Earth.
Oh, you heard earth, and I said birth.
Birth! Oh.
Earth, we did them both.
I heard birth.
Two for one.
Compost.
How many besides me have been too tired and just thought it was the end, and then all of a sudden that energy comes from somewhere, and you pull something, something is pulled out of you that you didn't know you had.
Second wind.
Rebirth.
Yes.
Rebirth, yeah.
But rebirth on earth as an adult.
Yes. How do you want to phrase that? How do you want to...
Well, one time I was running in a wheat field and the wind was blowing against me and I was a little kid and I just could barely make it. And then something happened, the wind didn't stop. But suddenly I could run freely, and that's the best way I know to describe it.
So second wind, is what
you say? Yeah, yeah.
Or breath?
A new breath that is easier than the old breath. A new unlabored breath.
Oh, that's beautiful. A new... Where else?
Dawn.
Dawn.
What about when a person shakes an addiction?
Recovery.
Yeah. Just put shakes an addiction. How many people have attended deathbeds? Do you ever see resurrection there?
Sure.
Sometimes you can, yeah. Hi, Scott. Hi, Pastor Scott.
It's a cheat of being discreet for that.
In conversation, in kingdom conversations, I would call it, where it's just, seems like you're connecting with that eternal, you know.
Well, you know, Luther said that should be the third sacrament. After word and the table, conversation with the brethren, he put it. It's sacramental.
Yeah.
Okay. What about when you've had a conflict with someone and you make peace.
Forgiveness?
Yeah, forgiveness.
That's a
reconciliation.
Reconciliation?
There we go.
The two most fascinating letters in the Word are always, for me, are the R-E's. They keep popping up to as a way to say again. It's not,
renewal.
It's not the end.
R-E's.
Resurrection.
Oh, I see, yeah.
It's true.
So it's the againness. This is not the end.
Again.
You have a chance.
So even though the word survive doesn't exist by itself, what would it mean if it did?
Good question.
What was that question?
If the word, if you take the R-E away, That word doesn't exist in English, surrection. But what would it mean if it existed?
Right.
Got the comic rising? Or?
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I'm thinking about that because, you know, like insurrection,
yeah.
You know, other.
It's a rising,
yeah.
Kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, rising again.
Rising, yeah. I'm going to put that. Againness.
Some of the things like conversation and shapes and addiction is triggering something in me, but I don't know how to say it, but I'm thinking of like, particularly with like youth that are right on that edge of believing in themselves or saying the hell with me and the rest of the world, you know, when there's, I mean, it's like conversation, but I'm thinking of something specific, just where you can watch their actions and conversation or whatever, that moment of, I'm finding me and the world and rejoicing and not going the other. You know what I'm saying?
I do. It's sort of, maybe this is wrong, and you can tell me so, please. But somehow realizing that you're loved, is that?
Yeah.
Self-discovery.
Self-discovery.
Yeah.
But I believe that.
Faith in yourself.
Loving
yourself, maybe.
Yeah.
Knowing yourself as loved.
Knowing yourself as loved, yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I just had two words pop. I had never ending promise.
Nice. I like that. Anything else?
Kind of a weird way, but the ecological ecological phenomena of seeing things regrowing and being devastated and regrowth, and that is just, to me, shows me there's a God and there's hope and birth and death and all of those things through visually you see it on the earth, an ecological phenomena that replicates resurrection.
You know where I especially see that? I mentioned I was a botany major.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And when forest fires devastate things,
mm-hmm.
but then there's those trees or pine trees or poppies,
yeah.
that can only grow after a fire.
Yeah.
So, ecological phenomena.
That's
big words.
Word. But those are,
I don't know if I can spell it.
Phoenix.
While you're writing, the analogy to the forest fire rebirth of plants would be in the winter, snowshoeing, cross-country skiing, mountaineer, and the first thing to shoot up is often an avalanche. Little, you know,
mm-hmm.
pops up the green. So it's that same, you don't need to write anything, but it's that same thing.
Yeah. Or you see some like little wildflower growing and some crack of a rock that
yeah.
you're like,
yeah.
or I love desert flowers. You probably know belly
yep.
flowers.
Yep.
Do you know belly flowers? Belly flowers are my favorite because they grow in the desert. People just drive through the desert on their way to the next cool gas station for, you know, their pop and if you stop and you look, and you actually have to get down on your belly to see these tiny, tiny lilies and composites, because they're only a quarter of an inch high, but they're perfectly formed flowers.
I do know those ones.
What's that?
I do know those ones, where you have to lay on your belly.
You have to lay on your belly to see it, but when you get close enough, and you almost have to get a hand lens to see them, but if you, and it's like this stunning beauty of just this, the least of these, and no one knows.
Or go on a nature hike with Heather Murphy. She identifies the call of a bird that no one sees, and I haven't even heard.
You know, by the way, her, just to plug her thing, 10:50 today.
What's going on here?
Okay, good. Well, that's a pretty good start. And so now we're going to go into the text itself. And would someone like to read 16? Mark 16:1-8, do I have a volunteer to read that?
When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Salome, brought spices so that they may go and anoint him. And very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. They had been saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance to the tomb?" When they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had already been rolled back. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man, dressed in a white robe, sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. But he said to them, "Do not be alarmed. You are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has been raised. He is not here. Look, there is the place they laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter that he is going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." So they went out and fled from the tomb, for terror and amazement had seized them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid.
That's where the Gospel of Mark ends. There's a, most scholars believe that that's where it ends. There's no sign of Jesus, and there's no resurrected Jesus in the Gospel of Mark. And so someone added on because, you know, they got really nervous about it later. Because it does make us nervous. And it should make us nervous, I think. Because we, post-resurrection people, have to live with that reality ourselves. So why, taking a look at this text, especially the last line, verse 8, I want you to focus on that. So they went out and fled from the tomb, for terror and amazement had seized them. And they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. How did this story get written?
Do we differ from the other Gospels?
Yeah, let's look at the, I mean, if you go back, if you go forward to Matthew, and you go to chapter 28. And I'll just read it. Just after the Sabbath, as the first day of the week was dawning, we're talking about dawning, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the tomb. And suddenly there was a great earthquake, which isn't in Mark. For an angel of the Lord descending from heaven, not in Mark, came and rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothing white as snow. There was just a boy, there's some kid in white. That's all that is the mark. For fear of him, the guards shook and became like dead men. But the angel said to the women, "Do not be afraid." Do not be alarmed, in Mark. "I know that you are looking for Jesus who was crucified. He is not here. For he has been raised, as he said." And so anyway, then we go on. And then it ends with verse 10 there. Then Jesus, suddenly Jesus met them and said, I'm sorry, verse 9. Suddenly Jesus met them and said, "Greetings." And they came to him, took hold of his feet, and worshipped him. Then Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee. There they will see me." And then at the very end of Matthew is the Great Commission. You know, we all know, many of you know that, "I am with you always to the end of the age, and go baptize and make disciples in my name." So you see Jesus at the end of Matthew.
But wasn't Mark,
what's that?
I mean, isn't Mark usually considered the earliest written, the first gospel?
Of the synoptics, yeah, it's the oldest.
Okay.
So let's go to Luke.
Yeah.
Luke 24. What's that?
That abrupt ending in Mark compared to the other three.
Oh, yeah.
It's always been.
But don't you get that in the news today? You know, you hear the first blurb, and then, okay, that's it. And then you get the next blurb, and there's a bit more. And then there's a bit more. Sometimes you prematurely report the news. You don't have the whole picture.
But why do you think then that Mark didn't include that? Why didn't he include the whole story? I mean, he says that, I assume it's a, he is a writer, he says that Jesus is ahead of you. Go there.
I wonder if Mark was separated from him for a while. I don't know, you know, is he writing somewhere else? You know, is he not with the community that came back?
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe he's just so afraid he just goes away to a cave somewhere and writes down what he knows fast.
Don't earlier recount stories have the fewest details usually?
Yeah, but it's interesting because according to the gospel, it's the only the women who witness this. So if we stick with the text and don't insert any other assumptions, it's only the women who saw them, according to Mark's account. And they said nothing.
I one time was spending the night with some people who didn't go to church, and I always wake up early, and it was Easter morning, and I went for a walk, and there was a Catholic church holding Mass, so I just went in, and the priest's first words, and he was preaching on this, and it was a little bit of an, he didn't add much, but he said, Jesus is loose in the world.
You know what? Well, let's actually, that's a great, we can jump to that. I'm going to jump to that in just a second because, well, we'll just kind of go, just Luke, as some of you know, there's the walk to Emmaus and the two friends, and they don't recognize Jesus, and Jesus is like talking with them, and they finally recognize him, you know, in the breaking of the bread and blah, blah, blah. I shouldn't say blah, blah, blah when I say Bible. And then in John, which is not one of the synoptics, and the last gospel written, we know that Jesus shows up and the disciples are hidden away, and he breathes on them and he says, your sins are forgiven, receive the Holy Spirit. And so there's appearances.
There's a kind of a progression. If you look at when the gospels are, you know, the timeline for the gospels, there's Mark, which ends abruptly. And then a little bit more gets added as each gospel is written and people understand, perhaps, what has happened.
Yeah, maybe. I learned this from Don Jewell at Luther Seminary, but we're going to jump around in our Bibles here, but I'm going to go back to what Trish says. Mm-hmm. And I think Mark is making another point. And so we're going to go all the way to Mark 1:9. I hear pages turning, so I'm waiting for pages to. Okay. In those days, Jesus came from Nazareth of Galilee and was baptized by John. Notice there's no, in the story, starts in Mark, it starts with John the Baptist. There's no Luke baby story. There's nothing like that. There's no, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was made flesh, as there is this John. It just starts right in. Like, it's like getting in a car with a teenager, and they hit the gas at 60, and you're like, whoa. So, he's baptized in the Jordan. Verse 10, and just as Jesus was coming out of the water, he saw the heavens torn apart and the Spirit descending like a dove on him. Now, he is the only one, in the Greek, he's the only one that sees this. In other gospel accounts, there's other people who see this dove. But that word torn apart cannot be translated into English very well. Oh, that's just green again. Oh well. It had a blue cap. Torn apart is schizomenophi. It's the same word as root word as we use in schizophrenia. So I'm just gonna. But it's this word in the Greek is a violent tearing. It's not just like ripping paper or parting as it is in the other gospels. There is, Don Jewell compared it to a lion tearing off the belly of a lamb. It's that violent. And there's no real word that we have, you know, we would have to add adjectives and adverbs to fill out this word. And so, and Jesus is the only one who sees this. Think back, okay, to the end of the Gospel of Mark. There's a secret there. Who knows in Mark 1 that this is the, you are my son, the beloved, with you I am well pleased? Who is the only one in this chapter 1 who knows that?
It's Jesus. How does Mark know it?
That's the fun part. That's the fun part. We don't know. I love that ambiguity. Some people are uncomfortable with it, and I think that's why they added the ending to the Gospel of Mark. Some people are uncomfortable with that ambiguity. But I kind of like that, because we live in a world of ambiguity. We live where we don't know. We live, and there's all, every single one of us at some point in our lives has wondered, where is God in this? I mean, I think that's a question of the prophets, that's a question of Job, that's a question of Peter, as Jesus is being crucified. What is God doing? How is God leading this? And so that ambiguity in Mark is kind of the human limitedness. But if you go through the Gospel of Mark, you'll find out that secret, and Jesus is always saying, don't tell anyone who I am, people find out. But it's usually the demons and all the who know, they recognize, they go, Jesus, Son of the Most Living God, heal me. And that it's like the demons who know who Jesus is. But no one else does. So this word torn apart goes back to what you were saying, Trish. Don Jewell argues that when the heavens tore apart, at that point, God was loosed into the world. Christ was loosed into the world. There's no separation now between where God is in heaven and God is on earth, even though most people don't know. Okay, let's go back to the end of Mark again. Sorry about that. Make you jump around. And if you go to, let's see, let's go to 15:33. When it was noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 in the afternoon. At 3 o'clock, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? Which is right from the Psalms. When some of the bystanders heard it, they said, listen, he is calling for Elijah. And someone ran, filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a stick, and gave it to him to drink, saying, wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to take him down. And there's a cynicism there. I think that's sarcastic. Then Jesus gave a loud cry and breathed his last. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Now when the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, truly, this was God's son. And that word torn apart, torn in two, the curtain of the temple, torn in two, is the same root word as this. So what's going on?
Well, the temple curtain was to divide, right, the Holy of Holies, the God's dwelling place from the rest of us, right?
Yeah, only, like, you could enter, because you're a man and you're a pastor. Being you again, sorry. It's just that when you're a pastor. The Holy of the Holies, there's, like, these circles. But the curtain temple kept the sinners out from the people who were not sinners, which would be the male priests. So all of a sudden there's this violent tearing of the curtain temple. Jesus breathes his last. And what happens in the temple?
God gets out again.
God is loose. Now God's not just in heaven. God is not a secret. God is in the world all over. And there's no division between the people and who God is. If God is loose in the world, unleashed.
And it's someone in the outer circle who recognizes it. No one in the inner circle sees it.
It's the one, actually one of the people who killed Jesus on the centurions, mm-hmm. who identifies this as God's son. In the very midst of God's abandonment. My God, why have you forsaken me?
Maybe he told the story.
What's that?
Maybe he told the story.
Some people, that's one of the things also that there's this, we'll go into it with this. There's this weird scene, and I mentioned this before in one of the Bible studies, that these people did not have, like, stacks of paper that they could print something out on and then, you know, like, oh, I don't want to make that copy and throw it away. These were, you know, scans, and every single word was very important. So they had to be careful with what they wrote. And so everything they wrote meant something. You know, they couldn't waste space here. So what did you just say that? So this secret, you know, meant something. This meant something.
That was John Wayne in the robe.
That's right.
We can refer to like Ben Hur. I love that movie.
None of the people in the inner circle recognized it.
Yes.
And then he sends them back to Galilee where he started.
In a circle. So where do you think resurrection might be in Mark? Is it necessary to see the living Christ to know resurrection? The resurrected Christ, I should say.
Is it true that the context of the people to whom Mark was writing were Christians who were living under persecution? Would that be a persecution time?
Yeah. And maybe some of the other clergy can help me out with this, but I know the temple hadn't been destroyed yet, I don't think. Had it?
A lot of people say that Mark 13 is like written with the temple destruction in mind.
Okay,
so they date it post. That's really why Mark, at least this is my take on it, is that's why Mark is dated post-temple.
Okay.
Just because they think that Jesus is actually, you know, it's almost like the character of Jesus is describing what's happening in the real world, and he's kind of forewarning it. I think that's right.
I've heard it explained to me taken in that context, it makes sense that Jesus is always saying, "Don't tell anybody who I am, and keep this to yourselves." And it's only until out here at the very end, when, as you put it, Jesus, God is now loosed into the world. Now it's okay because the purpose has been fulfilled now, and we don't have to be secret about this anymore.
But that's why I'm so fascinated with the very ending of John, where the women tell nothing to anyone.
Of Mark.
Yeah, it sort of undoes that. And
well, I would see that as still. They still didn't quite understand what this was all about.
Yeah, they were freaked out.
He had died, period. That was it.
And the body was gone.
Right.
Was it you, Brian? I'm sorry, Brian and I used to work we were brought, not together, but we worked in body removal as mortician's assistant, which is great. But wasn't it our boss, Anita, who said, if one of these bodies started moving, and do you mind telling that story?
Oh, man. No, I don't remember that story.
Maybe it wasn't you, maybe it was Mark Osley also. But anyway, Anita said, because, we drive around in this van and, you could fit two bodies in. And Anita, who was our boss, said, you would never expect to be a mortician at all. She's like this tall and totally pretty and like always had great eyeliner. But she also had a conceal and carry. Really happy.
Inside of her.
She was great. But anyway, she said, if one of these bodies started moving, I'd be out of this van so fast. And so you can imagine.
It's the risk you take.
Yeah, you can imagine that if you go to an empty tomb and you're like, okay, there's a big stone there. Where did the body go? Like, this, it would be a really terrifying thing.
Especially if you're sleepy.
Yeah.
I would picture the women as like they've been crying all night and they get up because they should and kind of wandering to the tomb trying to figure out what to do.
And you know
what? They get this. Like,
yeah, they're expecting someone starting to decay probably. It's not.
Yeah.
Well, you really have the ability to move. I mean, again, the fear of the government would be there. Who would have the ability or authority to move this big stone? I mean, you already killed him, but he's that dangerous, but he stole the body. And,
yeah. I mean, that was probably some of the fear, too, is maybe.
Really coming after me next, or I don't know.
Yeah.
It's not.
Body.
You just prank somebody. I mean, it's not worth the effort to.
Gotcha. I stole the body.
It's
like
somebody with power.
Someone with power.
In a way, I mean, Mark is different, but it's also similar because there's all those upper room situations where the disciples are hiding before Pentecost and John and Luke Acts. I mean, there's that sense of like they're supposed to be going and telling the story, but they're afraid and they don't tell anyone. They're stuck in that internal place. So there's some similarities.
Yeah, there are. So
when you mentioned the violence, I just thought of Shakespeare's line from Macbeth, ripped untimely from the womb, and they weren't ready for this. And the tomb is certainly like a womb in a way. And then just that phrase of Shakespeare's just occurred to me, ripped untimely from the womb. No one was ready for this, and it was violent. According to the Greek. And you can imagine back in Shakespeare's day what a Queen Caesarea that must have been.
Man, Trish, I love you. That's so beautiful. You quote from Macbeth and Aristotle. That's okay. So, we are all, some of us in this room pay the bills somewhat by being public preachers. But is there anyone in here who is not baptized? I only ask that because I work with people who are not baptized. But we as baptized people, no matter what you do in your job, are called to tell about this God you haven't seen. You're called to talk about an empty tomb. How do you do that? What do you say when you have nothing to say?
I suspect that like any honest witness would at least have both terror and amazement as part of them. Mm-hmm.
Is resurrection a sentimental notion?
Good.
All that stuff done.
Good. Good.
It comes out of death. It comes out of our fear. It comes out of our not knowing. It comes out of our sin. It comes out of our brokenness. It comes out of being limited human beings who must confess daily that we don't even know all the sins we commit. Only God knows. God has chosen us just like he's chosen the centurion and those women at the tomb to tell this story. And we do so not because we know so much, but because we're just of this earth. We are born here, die, but we live with this hope that Jesus has gone before us. And so that when we die too, and when we sin, Jesus has gone before us, already forgiving. That what happened in the cross and resurrection, even if we don't see it, even if we're not witnesses to it, this world has already been redeemed, and we live in that. And we as Christians follow. And that's all we can do. We can only follow the one to Galilee, the one who has claimed us in our baptism, just as Jesus was baptized.
Question then, what about those who, for whatever reason, have not been baptized? You know, it's the eternal question. Is that the
magic?
The magic, the key, the, yeah.
I mean, other people can comment on this. I don't think so. Just knowing the character of God, who God is, I don't think we have to jump through hoops and have,
okay,
that makes sense.
I'm talking about those who insist that has to come first.
Oh yeah, I know what you're talking about. I worked with Catholic nurses at the hospital who, when there's a child that's not going to make it, they're like, right, those nurses are right and they're baptized. Frankly, I don't really worry about it. I mean, I don't get into arguments about it, or I don't know how do other clergy or other leaders, or how do you deal with that? I don't know. I just don't get into baptism. I mean, I don't get into baptism arguments about when.
I think the more modern notion now is that you're a child of God even if you're not baptized.
Yeah.
And you know, where when I was a child, the common thinking was that you had to get your children baptized as quickly as possible in case something happened.
Yeah.
And we've sort of moved away from that, I think. I'd like to go back to that. You said, is this a sentimental notion, the resurrection? I'd like to sort of suggest that it's a romantic notion. Not sentimental, but romantic. That
nice.
We look for the limits that establish the state of humiliation against the state of exaltation, both coming in and going out. And so the ripping or the tearing at the baptism with John the Baptist is from the state of exaltation to the state of humiliation. And when we see Christ on the cross and the tearing at the temple, we see that reverse again. So we see that other scene where he goes from humiliation back to exaltation. And the resurrection is sort of putting a rubber stamp on the fact that He's gone from the state of being a man back to his position as the Godhead.
Say more about that rubber stamp thing.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, it's just a reaffirmation
okay.
of the fact that he has come and laid down his life, and that he's no longer man, that he's God. He's confirmed for us that he's fulfilled his purpose, and that we can feel assurance, and we can feel comfort, and we can feel the joy of his death.
Yeah.
And that we find birth in that death.
We find birth in that death, yes. I can't really tease apart the rest of the, I think what makes, you know, I think, you know, we confess as liturgical people that Jesus spent 3 days with Satan down, and we're going to talk about evil in a little bit with Judy, another plug, 10 o'clock. Jesus spent 3 days down in hell playing poker and smoking cigars and maybe, you know, fighting Satan down in hell. It probably wasn't a great time for God, the triune God. But, yeah, I don't think that, you know, the resurrection cannot be teased apart from the cross. And often what I see in churches, even in my own, is we make the resurrection triumphalistic. When, in fact, I would love it if a pastor, I walked in on Easter morning and a pastor said, "What have you come here to see? What are you doing here?" Because that would be more true to the text. There's no, I mean, and pretty much all the texts, there's no, like, trumpets blaring at the resurrection. I mean, we celebrate that, and we use trumpets, and we go, yeah, Christ is risen indeed, and that's great. But at the same time, the text itself is like, what have you come to see?
He has gone before you to Galilee.
Yeah, it just ended that way. Go, go, go. Go. That would be a real Easter service.
It's not party time. And that kind of, I like that. I'm like you. I like the ambiguity of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Because it makes hope genuine.
Yes.
Nobody can prove a darn thing. And you just have to hope that that's what happened.
Yeah.
And we sometimes forget, I think, that Mark and Matthew weren't around when this happened.
No.
This was not news reporters.
No.
They were just hearing what people had said.
Yeah.
We had, in the Bible class in our church, one of our retired pastors said that when it comes to, we were talking about, you know, life after death, the hope of resurrection, but then he said, well, and it has to do with the Greek word gnosis, gnostic.
Gnostic, yeah.
He said, I'm agnostic. I cannot tell you in a provable, empirical way what's going to happen to you. So in that way, in a sense, we're all probably agnostics. Because we don't know, we believe, we hope,
we see
have within us this yearning. But to be able to know in an absolute way, no. Because we are who we are, and there are just some things you have to trust God to know on your behalf.
I often refer to myself as a Christian agnostic.
Seems
and,
to me.
You know, I've used that word agnostic, and of course that makes everybody just jump because, okay, next to an atheist, that's almost as bad. But in that sense of the word, he's correct. You know, we are when it comes to resurrection, when it comes to that final part of our existence. We don't know.
It's sort of crazy, in fact. It's like, oh, wait, this guy came back from the dead, and that's the center of our religion. And then every week, if you have communion in your church, you celebrate that by eat his body and drink his blood. It's like kind of weird.
The words of the institution, you know, this is my body.
Given for you.
You know, if somebody didn't understand what that really meant, it came in there and just heard those words.
Oh,
some cannibals!
The early Christians. That's what there was whole articles written about the early Christians, being cannibals and even eating their children.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But
they don't eat them; they just drown them to death.
It's called baptism.
Yeah.
But there's knowing in your mind, and there's knowing in your heart.
There's
knowing in your heart. Faith comes in.
Yeah, and that's why we live by faith. That's why, I mean, that's what, and all the great theologians, Barth and, you know, Calvin, and their final things, they wrote blah, 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 you know, volumes of books, and then they finally ended up saying, you know what, on their deathbed, I really don't know.
One thing that, about Kierkegaard, there are two parts, but two things that particularly struck me, and this is one, anything you know for sure is boring. Like 2 + 2, who even thinks about that? And he does compare it to a young girl who is not sure whether her boyfriend likes her or not, and her excitement and joy when she sees him. And two people who maybe were never really strongly in love, but have hung together all these years, and they know each other is going to be faithful to them. And that's kind of knowing for sure versus the excitement of this girl who doesn't know whether her boyfriend likes her or not. And that's what he compares it to. But that's just, anything you know for sure is just immediately boring.
Yeah, I don't even know what's for lunch today. And you have been waiting so patiently.
Well, all of this kind of comes to me on this whole business of, I think it's a current, but it's also an ancient quest for certainty. I always thought of it as the curse of certainty. The issue is that we're servants in search of, what was the prayer? Ventures of which we cannot see the ending, through perils unknown. We go out through with good courage, not knowing where we go, but only that your hand is leading us and your love sustaining us. I've always thought that as the Holden Prayer, because I learned it in my heart 4 years ago out here felt that, you know, we're so intent on endings, but God is intent on us. And certainty closes that off. There's a dynamic of life that insists on hope and birth. I took a picture out here, I bought a picture out here of a stump. And there was a tree growing out of the middle of the stump. It's my whole picture, but that's that whole business of when we think that there's an ending, God's at foot. So the Mark ending is perfect.
It is. I think so too. I think so too.
You started the whole session with some quiet and some white space. And that's one of the reasons I like Mark, because there's plenty of white space in Mark for us to live.
Mm-hmm.
If we have all the ties tied up and everything buttoned up tight, with all the stories told, there isn't any room for me.
Yeah.
Right.
I think Mark gives us plenty of room to live.
That's yes.
With the terror and the amazement.
We live right in
it's, Mark has these great brackets.
Yes, the chiasms.
We live right there.
Yeah.
You know, that with both ends open for
us.
And I'm thinking it's like a your trumpets and blasting at Easter is like a wedding, you know, where we make this great announcement that, you know, love and what is that really? You know, are we really sure? We've got so much hope, but to know yourself as loved
I think, is to believe in the resurrection. But how would you explain that? How do we tell people about the resurrection? How do you tell people what that ring means on your finger?
I know.
You don't. You just live it.
You just live it.
You're like the women here. You just, you're dumbstruck.
And the last word in Mark is not the resurrection. The last word is, I'll meet you all in Galilee to tell you what you're going to do next.
Yeah.
And it's everyone's greatest fear, our greatest fear, their greatest fear, was they're going to die. Jesus basically said, hey, I've done this. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, like, see you later. Yeah. I'm already ahead of you.
And there's more important things to do.
Now we go. Well, we had, speaking of going, we have to close off, but thank you all for your very thoughtful comments. And I'll leave you with this benediction. Christ is with you. Now, go out and tell no one.